You're listening to Disinformed, a mini-series from There Are No Girls on the Internet. I'm Bridget Todd. Yesterday, the CEOs of Facebook, Google, and Twitter went before Congress to testify about the role that their platforms played in spreading the misinformation that led to the insurrection in January. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg proposed some limited reforms to Section 230, legislation that says that tech platforms can't be held liable for what people post on those platforms.
First, platforms should have to issue transparency reports that state the prevalence of content across all different categories of harmful content, everything from child exploitation to terrorism to incitement of violence to intellectual property violations to pornography, whatever the different harms are.
On this week's episode, we heard from Evan Greer, digital rights activist, about why she works with the organization Fight for the Future to preserve Section 230. Now, in the episode, Evan said that rushed changes to Section 230 could do more harm than good.
This is not about defending the companies. I don't particularly care very much about the company's profits or how much money they have to spend on lawsuits. What I care about is the impact that that then has on marginalized people's speech, and particularly social movements. And for me, Section 230 is such a crucial law for protecting speech, like, for example, a video of police violence, which in a world without Section 230 would almost certainly invite lawsuits from law enforcement who would claim that it's defamatory or that it's incitement, right? Like the Me Too movement, where, you know, people are able to speak out about abusive behavior and platforms are willing to host that speech because they know that they're not going to get sued for giving people a platform to speak and speak their truth. And so I always think about the impact on those movements. Fight for the Future sees Section 230 as one of the most important laws protecting free speech and human rights in the digital age. And that doesn't mean that we don't think it can ever be changed, right? No law is sacrosanct. Laws are just laws. But we are very concerned that, you know, rushed or uncareful changes to Section 230 will do far more harm than good.
So you might have already gleaned, there's a lot of debate about Section 230. Some people say it shields big tech companies from accountability, while others say it's the backbone of what makes the internet the internet. Last season, we heard from Carrie Goldberg, an attorney who fights things like revenge porn, stalking, and harassment on social media. In a groundbreaking case about a horrific harassment campaign being run on the dating app Grindr, Carrie argued in favor of changes to Section 230 in front of the Supreme Court. Let's listen into Carrie's story and why she says Section 230 needs to be changed. There used to be a time when we didn't really have a term for the idea of revenge porn. Spreading someone's intimate content online without their consent was just a thing that happened on the internet. Just last week, 19-year-old Aaron Coleman won the Democratic primary for a Kansas House seat. Even after admitting to obtaining nude photos of a girl when he was 14, trying to blackmail her into sending him more photos, and spreading them online when she refused. On Twitter, journalist Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept called Aaron's behavior, quote, bad middle school bullying. But this kind of behavior isn't just bullying. It's a serious sex crime. When we minimize revenge porn, we're contributing to an attitude that says once someone takes an intimate photo of themselves, they deserve whatever happens next, even if it means their life is destroyed, they're harassed, or worse. Luckily, women are fighting to build a better internet, one where we have the right to feel safe online. You could be forgiven for thinking of Carrie Goldberg as a real-life superhero. Instead of a cape, she rocks heels, bold statement glasses, and sometimes even caps it off with a baseball hat reading, "I sue abusers." With her law firm, she spent her professional life holding all manner of internet creeps, abusers, and stalkers accountable. Going head-to-head with powerful abusers and their enablers is scary, but Carrie has never been one to back down from a challenge. She represented Lucia Evans and Paz de la Huerta, who were among the first women who made public allegations against Harvey Weinstein, which led to his arrest. Her book, Nobody's Victim, is about her own experiences with an abusive ex, who vowed to use the internet to ruin her life, and her journey to become the lawyer she needed. Carrie has been responsible for creating a massive cultural change, around the kind of experiences marginalized people can expect from the internet. Her work, Creating Accountability for People Who Misuse the Internet to Cause Harm, forces us to ask, why should we accept mistreatment as a given? Why can't things be better? Carrie, it turns out, has been holding creeps accountable since the very beginning. So one of the stories I read about you is that when you were in school, one of your classmates was bragging about having gotten a handjob from one of your girlfriends, and you responded by gluing a bunch of amputated doll hands to a poster and giving it to him with a card that says, "We'll give you a hand." Has holding people accountable for their bad behavior always been a mission of yours?
Like, it didn't feel like it was a mission of mine, no. But it was a fun pastime. And I remember one of my friends was on the boys' soccer team, and she was the only girl on the team. We didn't have a girl soccer team in Aberdeen. And there was an incident where she was on the school bus, and they were going to an away game, and she fell asleep with her mouth open. And she told me about how when she woke up, there were all these pubes in her mouth. And all, I guess a bunch of her teammates had like plucked their pubes and put them in her mouth. Now, I was a member of the yearbook team, and I got assigned to write this story about the boys' soccer team. And I got kicked off the yearbook team, or the yearbook class, because the teacher had realized that the first letter of each word in the first couple sentences spelled out pubic pluckers. So, you know, now that's just like, that's a Title IX situation, you know, like her waking up and having, that's a disciplinary issue. Back then it was, we didn't think that much of it. It was playful, but I mean, she was the only girl on that team. You know, it's certainly impacting her enjoyment of it.
Boys will be boys. It's just a joke. She deserved it. I'd never let something like that happen to me. It's difficult for me to admit, but I've had these kinds of harmful victim-blaming reactions to hearing about the sexual abuse of a classmate. I was 15 and it was gossip, something to whisper about in homeroom. I got to feel like part of the in-group, judging another girl for something that was done to her. It was wrong, and I wish I had known better. Young me contributed to a culture that treated serious crimes and violations like some big joke. It wasn't a joke. Your work has been incredibly impactful for me, for my own process of understanding the cultural change that needs to happen around those kinds of stories, right? When I was in high school, I think I was in 10th grade, you know how every high school has that big scandal that happens in your class or in your school that everybody's talking about? In my school, it was a girl had sent intimate pictures to her boyfriend, clearly just for him, and he sent them to everybody. You know, we went to a pretty small school. It was an all-girls school where there was an all-boys school nearby. And these pictures were seen by everybody. And I hate to say this, it's like a shameful confession, but 15-year-old Bridget thought this was a joke, right? Like 15-year-old Bridget thought that because she had taken these pictures at all, she deserved what happened to her. She deserved to be shamed. And you know, I was very young, but looking back, I thought about it as a joke, right? I didn't think it was serious. And I thought that, you know, it was okay to make fun of her, to shame her, because she had done this to herself and she deserves it. And it wasn't until becoming older did I really step back and think, like, I was really complicit in continuing a cultural attitude that, A, when things like this happen, that it's just a joke, it's not serious, it's not a crime. And B, that the victims deserve to whatever like scorn or shame they get because they put themselves in this situation. And I guess my question is, how do we get to a place where more people go through that process of being like, oh, well, actually, I believe some pretty fucked up stuff about victims, about sexualized violence. And I have a role in making sure that people, everybody understands that these are very serious.
I mean, Bridget, what you're talking about is like, it is the issue. You know, like most of my underage clients, almost all of them are that victim, are the person that the scandal around the high school is orbiting around. And it is like the issue is that kids don't learn empathy. They don't develop empathetic skills until later on, and they can't role reverse with the victims. And so instead, they want to be, there's a natural instinct in all of us to want to be part of the gossip and part of the story and to see the picture that everyone else is seeing and talking about. And not to be the like upstander who is like, that's actually a sex crime. And everyone who's looking at that and has it on their phone and is sending it to other minors is actually engaging in a felony, you know, child pornography, like felonious behavior. But the issue is that that attitude of victim blaming and stuff, which is really natural in kids, it's also frequently present in the administrators, in the school resource officers who are cops, and even in the people, in the parents who get involved, including sometimes the victim's parents. A lot of times our clients don't take immediate action because they're afraid of their parents disciplining them. And it's just, you know, we talk about consent education and how we need to teach kids about consent, but a big component of that is about empathy and just, you know, doing role reversal exercises where kids have to imagine what it's like to be in somebody else's shoes. And I think that's important when we're talking about race and gender and also victimization.
One of Carrie's clients, a Brooklyn teen with mental disabilities, was raped in a stairwell while at school. When she reported what happened, her school counselor decided that she was at fault and suspended her. Sadly, her story is not really that uncommon. School-aged Black and brown girls are more likely to face interpersonal violence at school and are also disproportionately criminalized and punished. Carrie's client won a $950,000 settlement against the city, and a city spokesperson promised $47 million annually in school climate training programs. It won't undo the hell she suffered, Carrie said, but it will buy her some comfort and healing.
You know, it's not necessarily about suing, although I am a big believer in that when the circumstances are right, but it's like amplifying your voice. And I mean, sometimes when I would be writing my legal complaints in preparation of lawsuits, I would get so emotional that I would just go on these like Twitter, like storms, you know, just like diva fits. But even that, you know, those would get retweeted. And by the time I filed my complaints, I had a lot of journalists that were in line to cover them. Some of it's just like letting the natural rage of the injustice like speak for itself.
Let's take a quick break. And we're back. Carrie has a real connection to her clients. She rages about the injustices they face on Twitter. She uses her own experiences to help them combat stigma and shame and let them know they're not alone.
I feel very invested in making the process of the litigation or getting justice tolerable because it can take years and you need them to be able to feel like it's worth it. And it's stressful at times and it can be very invasive, you know, like when you're having to relive, when you're only 16, 17, you're having to relive this awful thing that happened to you when you're 13. You need to like feel like it's for something really important. And also just getting back to what you were talking about, Bridget, about how, you know, when we're young, we can actually be complicit in some of the violation. It makes me think about how much more traumatizing it is to be a victim when you're young, and where not only have our violators not developed the skill of empathy, but the victims haven't figured out how to cope, and it can feel like your whole world is crushing around you if you are not only sexually violated, but then all the students in your class you know, think you're a joke and are spreading it. And, you know, you're afraid your parents are going to punish you, and you're afraid your school's going to punish you. And like, kids already don't have control over their lives. And then to be kind of socially ostracized or put in this category of other and have your friendships kind of crumble, like that can create such desperation. And every single one of our young clients has been suicidal during those moments. It's just like, they don't have the coping skills. I didn't when I was that age.
When Carrie was younger, she was victimized by abusive exes. One had intimate images of her and vowed to use them to ruin her life. This was before revenge porn was even really a thing. People didn't know how to talk about it or deal with it when it happened. And lawyers didn't really know how to handle what she was going through. In your book, you talk about how you became the lawyer that you wish you had had in your 30s. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah. Well, I had some violence. You know, I was a victim of some dating violence and incident of sexual violence before I started my law firm. And when I was trying to escape my ex-boyfriend's stalking, and he was just besieging me with text messages and threats and false police reports, and it was never ending. I had trouble finding a lawyer. I worked with somebody on the domestic violence piece. I worked with somebody on the bogus criminal complaints piece. But for everyone that I talked to, this was a real like abnormal case for them. You don't want to be the outlier when it comes to getting legal help and having a lawyer, be kind of learning as they go. And it was unpredictable for them, you know, what would happen or the kind of the profile of my offender was something really new to them. And when I finally got my orders of protection and he pled guilty, which was 6 months after the breakup, I quit everything and started my law firm a few months later when I was, you know, in retrospect, I was still in the midst of a lot of trauma, but I started this law firm basically to become the kind of lawyer that I'd needed, because I'd gotten this kind of involuntary education into the world of being stalked and having no control over what's happening in the internet. And I learned that in New York, we didn't have a law criminalizing, somebody sending around your naked pictures. And so the internet component of the attack on me was the most scary thing the scariest part about it, because even after I got my order of protection, I knew that legally he could still be sending around my images. He, you know, as far as I know, he didn't, but there was always this like thing, this that he had threatened to, and he had sent me emails saying that he, with the picture, saying that he'd blind copied, people that I was, like other lawyers and judges and stuff. But it was like this constant anxiety that like, I wasn't protected even after all the legal issues had seemingly wrapped up.
Carrie became one of the most prominent lawyers specializing in revenge porn and offers victims legal support and a pathway to justice, whatever that looks like for them.
Our expertise is dealing with people who've been stalked and harassed and victims of sexual assault and sexual trauma, and getting justice for them. Sometimes it's just about getting an order of protection or helping advocate in the criminal justice system or just sending a cease and desist and getting the offender to go away forever. Other times the victim doesn't want to take any legal action but just wants those images to be removed from the internet. And then we also do sometimes have really big cases against the city of New York when there's a retaliation against a student, or our big case against Grindr because we felt they were facilitating our client being stalked. But basically the idea is that every client that comes to us has either been attacked or is under attack. And so we know what to do. And we've seen all these behavioral profiles over and over again. And the more you do something, the more expert you get. And so we can predict, you know, well, by sending a cease and desist letter to this kind of behavioral profile who is mentally ill and unrelenting and obsessed, we can know that's just going to escalate things. Whereas, oh, this other person, he's threatening revenge porn, but he's actually got a really stable job and lives with and has a kid. And he's actually going to feel scared of a threat because it could take things away from him.
More after this quick break. Let's get right back to it. Carrie's case against the dating app Grindr was one of the biggest fights of her career. In it, she sets her sight on legislation called Section 230, which basically says that tech platforms can't be sued for what people say on those platforms. Now, free speech advocates like the Electronic Frontier Foundation say Section 230 is what makes the internet the internet. But Carrie says that's exactly the problem.
Forgive me if I bungle this. From my kind of layperson's research, I understand that it really comes down to Section 230, which I know that is something that you really, really have an issue with. You know, this is the section that allows tech companies to not be held liable for things that are said on their platform, the way that their platforms are used. Free speech advocates say that section is what makes the internet what it is, but you say that's exactly the problem, right? That we should be thinking about the internet in a different way. We should be building a different internet. I guess, how do we reconcile those two arguments, I guess? You know, is there some way to preserve free speech online while also not letting tech companies just avoid accountability for the way that their platforms are misused?
Oh my gosh, I have so much to say to this. Bridget, you framed it better than I could. Our client, Matthew Herrick, was a waiter / actor / former reality star who lived in Manhattan in Harlem. And he had just ended a relationship with a really controlling and abusive man. And among the ways that man stalked Matthew was he started creating fake profiles on Grindr, the gay dating app, and then luring people to Matthew's job and to his home using Grindr's geolocating technology and DMing with the unknowing people. And over the course of several months, over 1,300 individuals came in person to Matthew's apartment and to his job, thinking that they were there to have sex with him. So imagine, just in the course of this interview, if your buzzer rang three times with, you know, so it was sometimes as many as 23 people a day, Bridget. And, you know, each time he didn't know who it was going to be. He didn't know if that person was going to be dangerous. Sometimes Matthew's ex would torment and taunt the visitors and say homophobic or racist things, or say that Matthew had free drugs. And so sometimes the visitors would come really angry or tweaked out. But always they were there thinking that Matthew had rape fantasies and stuff. So, I mean, it was scary. It was a crime that was happening to Matthew day in and day out, every single day. And Matthew had gone to the police 10 times. He'd gotten an order of protection that the offender was violating over and over again. And nothing mattered. Matthew flagged the accounts with Grindr about 50 times by the time we came along. And then I had just worked with a bunch of big tech companies at the time. This is the fall or the end of 2016. And I'd worked with a bunch of tech companies on their revenge porn policies. And so I was super like, I'll just call up Grindr's general counsel and get them to remove this user. And they ignored me too. And so I was like raging with him. And we ended up getting a restraining order against Grindr, saying that they had to remove this user, which, you know, it's not super common to get a restraining order against a tech company. But we got it. And Grindr even ignored that. The visitors kept coming. And we, as we, you know, plotted our lawsuit against Grindr, we had to worry about the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, which was this law, as you mentioned, that went into effect back in 1995, when the internet looked nothing like it does now. And the law was actually, you know, it was just a 26-word law that was part of a bigger law that basically banned pornography on the internet. But the other part of that law got deemed unconstitutional, in case you're wondering why we have porn on the internet. It's not constitutional to outlaw it, but this little section survived. And it originally was supposed to just make it so that, you know, if a bulletin board, which was basically the way that, you know, people talk to one another online, if somebody posted something defamatory on the bulletin board, there wouldn't be a lawsuit against the bulletin board, but the defamation would be user to user. And it, you know, kind of makes sense, because then the platforms are not tasked with this burden of having to moderate all the speech and all the posts and stuff like that. But the issue is that over the last, you know, 25 years, that law has been interpreted by our courts in this really expansive way. And so anytime, you know, Twitter or Facebook or anybody gets sued for something that's happening to a user, they say, we're not liable because of Section 230. You know, like, you can't hold us accountable for anything that one user does to another. And courts have, you know, said, you're right, because all the other cases before you didn't.
It's important to emphasize that Carrie isn't just talking about what someone says on a platform. If a platform allows an abusive user to impersonate you and set you up for a dangerous encounter in real life, it's a pretty big flaw.
The issue is that the internet and apps and the, you know, are so much different now than they were. And we're not just talking about defamation. We're talking about, you know, geolocating technology and you know, social media companies, which have so much functionability. And we're talking about, you know, dating apps, you know, and apps that are playing a role in matching users. And so, but we had to make it when we were filing this lawsuit so that we were not suing Grindr for anything that Matt's ex was doing to Matt, because we knew it would get kicked out of court for violating Section 230. And so when Grindr's lawyers finally came to court and told us that they didn't have the technology to ban an abusive user, we were like, what? Like, you have the world's biggest dating app, and it's so foreseeable that biggest dating app, you know, for gay people, it's so foreseeable that sometimes it's going to be abused by stalkers, by predators, and you've not designed into it like a way to stop abusive users? Well, then you've released a dangerous product into the stream of commerce. And just like our product liability laws for cars, you know, that have airbags that don't go off or broken brakes or something, like, Grindr had created a dangerous product. We say you shouldn't have been on the market in the first place. And the fact that you are, well, that's how we're going to sue you. Grindr still said, well, you're at the end of the day, you're still holding us liable for stuff this user's done to Matthew. It's not us. And the judge agreed with Grindr, and we appealed and kept losing at every stage, and ultimately petitioned to the Supreme Court and lost. And which happened, you know, this was from the beginning, a real, it was a very experimental lawsuit. Like at the time that we filed it, it was novel for us to even be, for anybody to even be referring to apps as products. Everyone was saying they're services, but now this idea has caught on and it's kind of changed the way that that we think about apps and internet products. And the fact that we did have such, you know, that Matthew experienced such a horrific thing and he couldn't get justice, that's actually helped us fight for legislation. And so, as you mentioned, you've got all these people on the other side that, and I don't actually think it's all these people. I think they're just very vocal and they're getting paid a lot of lobbying money from big tech.
Is the internet we have now working for everyone? Is it the version of the internet we want? Is it one worth preserving as is? Carrie doesn't really think so.
But they're saying that, that basically the internet as we know it wouldn't exist without Section 230. And we're going to lose, you know, all the this wonderful free exchange of ideas if we lose Section 230. And I call total BS on that. Because number one, you're assuming that the internet as we know it is a great place and that as we know it, like should be, you know, like preserved. Just, you know, it's kind of like any constitutional argument or make America great again. You're assuming that it is, that things are great. And, you know, you're assuming that, you know, that everyone has the same level of free speech. But I mean, speech on the internet really belongs to those who are the loudest and you know, for companies, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft and Apple. I mean, they control the internet and we've got all our issues with antitrust. And then you've, and also the quantity. So the most hostile people on the internet are the ones who have the greatest protections. But also when we're talking about lawsuits and the right to sue, it's such a fundamental right.
Carrie says that as long as tech companies have the kind of legal protection afforded to them by Section 230, it creates a situation where there's not a lot of avenues to hold them accountable.
You know, like the thing is, like, as you see with our cases against the New York City Department of Ed, like for the cost of an index number, which is a couple hundred bucks, which you can get waived. I had a client who, you know, whose mom was a part-time home health aide and didn't speak English, you know, and they had no money to speak of. I had her suing the city of New York, which is worth multi-billion dollars. And that's the great equalizer in our country, is that anybody can sue, even, you know, if there's been a harm. And it's fundamental. And it's also how we keep our big organizations, our companies, from being total assholes. Because the threat of being sued is hits you in the bottom, you know, it's a bottom line issue. It costs money. And it's why, you know, like so many safety measures, whether we're talking about pharmaceuticals or cars, it's because of litigation that happened, or it's because of the fear of litigation. And also it's because most companies want people to be safe. They want their customers and clients to not have a bad experience. You don't see that with big tech though. You know, like the wall off, you know, like if you had a crisis on Facebook, if let's say you're a parent and your kid was manipulated into giving nudes to a pedophile, and then he was sharing them online. You're a parent. Your first instinct was, who do I talk to? Who do I talk to? What's the phone number? Who's live to help me with this crisis? And it's just like a one-way street here, where we're giving these companies all this information about us and stuff, and we can't. I mean, they are like, it's like Oz. Like they're the behind this magic curtain and don't have to interact with us users.
So as you were talking, it occurred to me that when you first started your law firm, the idea of revenge porn didn't even really exist. And it was through advocating for legal protections and working with victims that you helped usher in both a legal change and a cultural reimagining of what revenge porn actually is. And in listening to you talk about tech companies just now, it seems like you're poised to do that same kind of thing again when it comes to reimagining what role tech companies should play in creating an internet that's safer for everyone. Like a hard reset of how these companies operate.
Yeah. I mean, it's true, Bridget. There's so much work that can be done. And like, it's a really critical time because you have all this concentrated power and wealth in such a few companies. And that the inequality in our society is just getting greater, you know, because of these companies, because and also the power and the omniscience is also, you know, another thing that's just creating so much more inequality in our country. And the thing is, I do have so many cases where it's, you can't ignore that the facts are horrific. You know, an 11-year-old who was sextorted and made to create all these videos and they were sent around on Instagram, or my client whose murder was basically live streamed, or another client who was raped and murdered on a first date through Match.com by a known sex offender. Like, there's gonna become a point where the more cases, like that, okay, even if these cases can't be brought in court or get kicked out, like you can't deny that there is extreme negligence by these companies. Like, and I'm gonna just keep producing them until we get new law. And it's just like any other case where if you don't feel like you can become a victim, then you're not gonna care. But the whole purpose of my book and everything is to pound into the consciousness that we're all a moment away from becoming victims. Like, all it takes is one person to decide they want to destroy you. You have one bad interaction at the supermarket with somebody who finds out your name. They then have the right to go to pedophile websites and tell the world that you're a pedophile, and good luck getting that down. You know, like, it's, anybody can become a victim, but it shouldn't take that in order for us to have empathy toward victims and want to change the internet. And it's, you know, like this, we're not talking about, you know, somebody calling somebody else a bitch on Twitter. That's not the kind of speech that's going to be impacted. And we're not even talking about speech really, because this is all conduct, you know, but our law doesn't even see the difference there. I would, you know, like with Grindr, we weren't suing them for any words on the profile or any words on the DM. We were suing them because this product was being used, you know, hundreds of times a day to try to get our client injured. It's not a speech issue. This is unjust.
Carrie's work isn't just about the law. It confronts the cultural attitude that people who are victimized online deserve it, or that it's just a sexy scandal rather than a serious crime, or that we should just expect that the internet is a place where we'll be mistreated. Why can't it be better than that? So what has it been like to have such a personal hand in challenging the internet to be better and safer and stronger, and working to build one where people with power are held accountable?
Well, it's so kind of you to describe me that way. I really feel flattered about that. You know, I love my job, and I love that as the owner of this law firm, I can decide what direction we go in and what fights to choose. I mean, that is an incredibly privileged and in position to be in. And, you know, like, there are ways to use your law degree in a super awesome, fun, creative way. I mean, what's it been like? It's just like been fun. But there aren't moments where I wake up and I feel like, oh, I'm this like really, you know, I've done it. You know, like I've made it. Because there's always somebody waiting to give me a bad verdict, or, you know, a troll that, you know, cuts me down to size, or, you know, like, there's, you know, there's very fleeting moments of well, what should I call it? Fleeting moments of like success. I'm proud of what we do. I'm so proud of my staff. But we're always humbled by the next fight.
On her website, Carrie says the clients she works with aren't fragile like a flower. They're fragile like a bomb. Through her work with those clients, Carrie is blowing up our understanding of the internet by asking the big, bold questions about how it can be better. She's taken the darkness she faced and used it to build a brighter future. If you enjoyed this podcast, please help us grow by subscribing. Got a story about an interesting thing in tech or just want to say hi? We'd love to hear from you at hello@tangodi.com. Disinformed is brought to you by There Are No Girls on the Internet. It's a production of iHeartRadio and Unbossed Creative. Jonathan Strickland is our executive producer. Tari Harrison is our supervising producer and engineer. Michael Amato is our contributing producer. I'm your host, Bridget Todd. For more great podcasts, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.